Well, our theme this evening is pride and humility. Pride and humility. And I guess not many of us would disagree that there's something very attractive about someone who's humble. Humility is a really appealing trait to see in someone. And the claim of the Bible is that God loves humility as well. So in passages like the one we read at the end there in verse 14, we see that God exalts the humble. Isaiah tells us that the high and lofty one lives with those who are contrite and lowly in spirit. James and Peter both remind us that God opposes the proud but gives grace to the humble. But I guess that not many of us would disagree as well that there's something difficult, there's something slippery, if you like, about humility. Most of the time it seems almost impossible to get hold of. It's certainly much more difficult to find a truly humble person than it is to find a proud person. And the passage we're looking at tonight really deals with these themes, and it describes for us both a proud person and a humble person. Jesus presents to us in this parable a proud Pharisee and a humble tax collector. And in doing so, he gives us a real insight into the pride that lurks in our hearts. But he also gives us hope in the battle against that pride. So I want us to look very simply this evening at each of these two characters in turn. We'll look firstly at the Pharisee's pride, and then secondly at the tax collector's humility. So firstly then, the Pharisee's pride. And I want us to look firstly at some symptoms that we see of this pride in this Pharisee, and secondly, the heart of this pride that lies behind those symptoms, what causes those symptoms to appear. So firstly, then, in verses 10 to 12 of this parable, we can see some of the symptoms of this Pharisee's pride. And as we look at these symptoms, I think what we find is that these symptoms are our symptoms. Now, what lurks inside this Pharisee so often lurks inside you and me. So it's important that we look at them. And I think there's three key symptoms here that we can see in the way this Pharisee behaves. So let's look at those three symptoms. Firstly, the first symptom I've called externalism. In verse 11, the Pharisee's prayer begins by thanking God that he's not like other men. And then he proceeds with this list of all the people that he's not like. And the list is like a who's who of wrongdoers in first century Israel. So he names the robbers, the evildoers. The word there means those who cheat, those who are treacherous. He names adulterers and tax collectors. And effectively, he congratulates himself that he's nothing like them. In contrast, then, in verse 12, he describes what he is like. He fasts twice a week and he gives a tenth of all he gets. This is a man who does good things. And incidentally, we have no reason to doubt that that's true. There's no suggestion here that he doesn't do these things, that it's not true what he's saying here. But what we do notice, or what we do need to notice, is the comparison that he's making here. What's the basis of this comparison that he makes? On what basis does he differentiate himself from the robbers, the cheats, and the adulterers? Well, quite clearly, it's on the basis of external actions. The measure, according to this Pharisee, by which he can congratulate himself and condemn others is on the basis of outward actions. It's on the basis of external goodness, on the basis of moral performance. Notice that he picks on some pretty obvious outward sins at that. Robbery, extortion, adultery, tax collecting. These were all sins that were the subject of public moral outrage in first century Israel because they were obvious public sins. They were testable, easy to recognize, easy to categorize misdemeanors. The kind of sins that you could use to pigeonhole people. Well, he's a robber and she's an adulteress. No mention in the Pharisee's prayer then of those more subtle, refined, respectable sins. The sins of nice people. Sins that could be committed regularly without losing your position on the Sanhedrin or the eldership or the list of people who get asked to do the spiritual stuff in church. Things like gossip or judgmental criticism or a little bit of mild dishonesty. But even those things only scratch the surface, don't they? They're only skin deep. They're still external, even though they're subtle. What about those things on the inside? And notice that there's no mention of those things either here. The things that drive what we say and do, those inward character traits that command our outward actions. No mention of gentleness, of kindness, of respect or love or humility. No mention of getting rid of bitterness or resentment or pride or envy. These things aren't on this Pharisee's radar. Everything about this Pharisee's prayer portrays a concern with the outwards, with keeping up appearances, with the everyday performance of righteous rituals, whether it's fasting or giving or going to the right meetings or calculating our every word to make us sound good, even if that means putting ourselves down, or reading the right books and criticizing the wrong books, or quoting the right people or wearing the right facial expression when we sing our favorite hymn. If we're honest, it's so often with this Pharisee, but also with us. It's so often all so calculated. It's external. It's crowd-pleasing Christianity. The way of the Pharisee is the way of focusing on obvious externals. Inward character doesn't matter. Subtle sins fall by the wayside in the relentless pursuit of a good reputation. So firstly, there we have externalism. Secondly, comparison. The second symptom we see is that the Pharisee is constantly comparing himself with others. We've already said that the Pharisee measures his moral standing on the basis of external performance. But what we also see here is that he measures his own external performance against the external performance of others. His concern is to outperform those around him. His confidence in his own morality comes from comparing that morality with those around him. It's another symptom of this Pharisee's proud heart. And my guess is that if you're anything like me, then it's another symptom that you're all too familiar with yourself. We see it rearing its head, don't we, on an individual level, when our measure of our spiritual performance is the performance of the person sat next to us in church. When we're comfortable in our Christian life, as long as we keep ourselves a few points ahead of everyone else in our mental, moral league table. Or when the only thing that pricks our conscience and spurs us into action to perform better is when we see someone else raising the performance bar by doing something good that we just wish we'd thought of doing first. But not just on an individual level, we see it on a collective level as well, when the church constantly bemoans the moral decline of society without even thinking of pointing the finger back at ourselves in recognition of the fact that more often than not, the moral state of society is nothing more than a pretty accurate barometer of the spiritual life and vitality of the church. We see it in us as individuals and in us as communities. But the Pharisee does something more here than just simple comparison with others. What's interesting in verse 12, if you look there with me, is that the Pharisee raises the bar against which he's comparing those around him. Because the interesting thing about the two specific things that the Pharisee mentions in verse 12 is that they both go beyond the requirements of the Old Testament law. There were requirements for fasting in the Old Testament law, but to fast twice a week blew those requirements out of the water. This was really impressive. Unquestionably, this guy was out fasting the Torah. He was really going for it on the fasting front. And then on the giving front, the requirement of the Old Testament was to tithe a tenth of all you earned, all your earned income. So it's a bit like a 10% income tax paid to the temple. But to give away a tenth of all you got, all you had, that was uber giving. That was mega giving. That wasn't just 10% income tax, that was also 10% capital gains tax, 10% inheritance tax, and 10% VAT, regardless of whether the supplier had already paid it. 10% on everything. This was giving well beyond what was required by the law. And this is the standard that the Pharisee sets for everyone else. This is the basis on which he boldly declares that he's not like other men, that he's better. A standard well beyond what the Bible requires. In other words, he was comparing himself with others based on his own moral preferences, based on his areas of moral strength. And again, don't we see this symptom all the time in ourselves? How often we compare ourselves with others in this selective sort of way. We compare others with ourselves in areas where we know we perform well, whilst completely ignoring those areas where we know we fail. Have you ever noticed how Christians who are less academically inclined, for example, are so quick to criticise theologians for sitting in their ivory towers and not doing anything useful for the kingdom? Whilst on the other hand, those who are more academically inclined are quick to respond by accusing less academic Christians of not reading enough Christian books or bemoaning the lack of thinking Christians in the church. Have you ever noticed how we're so quick to criticise people for not going to the prayer meetings we go to, but neglect to mention the ones we don't? Have you ever noticed how Christians who live frugally are quick to point out the rampant materialism within the church? How Christians who find it easy to talk to strangers are quick to criticise the church for not being welcoming enough? How Christians who find it easier to engage with modern culture and make friends easily with non-Christians jump on the cultural irrelevancy and introspectiveness of the church, whilst those who find it harder to engage with culture criticise those who do so for selling out to the world. But on the areas where we're weak, on our moral blind spots, we're not so quick on the uptake. We do this all the time, this selective self-comparison. I do this all the time. And it betrays the Pharisee heart in me. It betrays it in all of us. There's a third and final symptom of pride that we see in this Pharisee, and it's what I've called inconsistency. And what I mean by that is that the private thoughts, the private words of this Pharisee are inconsistent with how he performs in public. If you're anything like me, then by now when you hear the word Pharisee and when you read Jesus' teaching against Pharisees in passages like this, you piece together in your mind this mental image of a smarmy, strutting, arrogant scumbag, really, who publicly paraded the fact that he thought a great deal of himself. But there's no reason from this parable to think that this Pharisee was like that. And if we head off down that route, then we're in danger of missing the point that Jesus is making. What do I mean? Well, we'll notice that Jesus isn't talking here about a public event. The Pharisee has gone to the temple for private prayer. Okay, other people, including the tax collector, would have been there and might well have noticed him. But the words he speaks here would have been words spoken in private. This is no longer part of the public performance. This is what's going on beneath the surface. What we have in these words is what's really behind the sham. What's underlying the external performance. Jesus rips the top off this man's religion and shows us the pride that's lurking underneath. And it's these private thoughts that betray him. Looking on from the outside, there's no reason to think that the Pharisee would have appeared arrogant or self-righteous necessarily. There's no reason for us to think he would have stood out as someone who's self-important and religious. He may well have seemed very generous, very kind-hearted, very committed, very self-sacrificial, perhaps. But it's what's going on the inside that betrays him. It's these private reflections on his public life which reveal everything, which show up his proud, proud heart. And only you know if you have this third symptom. Only you know what goes through your head when you reflect on your moral performance, when you compare yourself to the other people in the church, when you muse on how people will respond in approval to that show of kindness you're planning or that sermon you're preparing. Only you know that. But my guess is that often it's not much different from the Pharisee, what goes through your mind in those situations. My guess is that underneath the surface, beneath the sham, you're not that much different from him. Because my guess is that you're probably not that much different from me. So we've seen what the symptoms of this Pharisee's pride look like. But we need to draw these things together to a diagnosis. What is it that's behind this man's symptoms? What's causing this? What's lurking in his heart to provoke this proud behaviour? Well, as we look at these symptoms, the picture I think we build is the picture of someone who's absolutely desperate for the approval and the exaltation of other people. He's desperate for other people to look at him and think he's okay, think he's great, in fact. That's why he's so concerned with external performance. That's why he's constantly making sure that he's ahead of the game, that he stands out from the crowds. That's why what he does in public is so inconsistent with what he thinks and says in private. He's looking for the exaltation that Jesus describes in verse 14. He's desperate for that exaltation, but he's looking in completely the wrong place. He's looking for it from other people. And so in order to get that exaltation, that approval, that glory and honour, he creates this facade, this masquerade. And this same motive lurks in all of our hearts. This desperation for approval. This desire for the acclamation of others. For people to tell us that we matter, that we count, that we're important. After all, we were made as people who are important, weren't we? We were made as people in the image of God. We were made as people who were never meant to be forgotten, who were meant to live forever. And yet we threw it all away. And now we're desperate, desperate to get it back. But we look in all the wrong places to find it. That's what lurks in our hearts, even now, and causes these symptoms. And that's what needs to change if we're to ever shed our pride and be truly, truly humble. So much then for the pride of the Pharisee. Let's then contrast that with the second character in the second scene of this parable and shift the spotlight to the tax collector's humility. And again, I want us to look at three symptoms of this humility and then look finally at the heart behind the symptoms that causes this humility. And what we'll see is that the three symptoms we notice here correspond with the three symptoms that we saw in the Pharisee. I'm afraid that means that the titles for them aren't very imaginative. They're just a reversal of the symptoms we saw at work in the Pharisee. So sorry that doesn't make your notes particularly interesting if you're taking them. But nevertheless, number one, no external pretense. No external pretense. Firstly, this is what we see in the tax collector. We see that true humility drops the externalism of the Pharisee. Because what's immediately evident, isn't it, when we look at this tax collector, is that the sham is gone. The pretense of external moral performance has been stripped away. We can imagine that what the tax collector does here wasn't really the done thing in the temple. I don't know exactly what beating your breast looks like, but certainly it doesn't sound like dignified temple court behaviour. But what we see here in this tax collector is that the facade of respectability has been stripped away. And underneath is this kind of bare, naked brokenness that he displays in this as he prays in the temple. And it's a brokenness that he freely confesses. In contrast with the Pharisee's many words, his only words are a plea for mercy, a cry for help from a place of helplessness and brokenness. What we see here is that true humility begins with this bare brokenness before God, which only comes when the pretense before men is stripped away. So the question for us is, do we still hold up the pretense? Do you still calculate all your interactions with others and with God in order to come out looking good? Or is there this bare, honest brokenness evident in your life? Are you willing to admit to mistakes, not just when it makes you look good, but when it shows up what's really in your heart? Are you willing to live with that kind of honesty, that kind of evident brokenness in your life, because we are all broken people? Or do you still want to cover it up and pretend like everything's okay? I wonder what a church of people who are willing to put on display this brokenness would look like. Tim Chesters, the British pastor and author, he wrote on exactly that question in his blog, and he described what he thought a church, what a church like this does really look like. He's talking about his church. He says, "Someone asked me how things were going recently. It's not really a yes or no, good or bad question. Life in our congregation is messy. People have a wide variety of problems, and many of those problems are out on the table. Are things going well when one of your members has been hauled out of a pub in a drunken state? When people admit problems in their marriage? When people are struggling with depression? Actually, I think the answer can be yes, things are going well. A key verse for me in recent years has been the first beatitude, which I paraphrase as, 'Blessed are the broken people, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.' God's blessing is found among the broken people. I don't rejoice in people's problems, but I do rejoice to be part of a community of broken people. I sometimes describe our church as a group of messy people led by messy people. It's proved a context in which I've been able to address my own struggles. What's the alternative? Well, one alternative is to be a church in which there's a lot of pretending, where people have problems, but the culture doesn't allow them to be open. Churches like this are very neat and respectable. But I know I'd rather be in a messy church. Mess reflects, I think, a culture of grace. We pretend because either we don't trust God's grace for ourselves, or we don't trust God, don't trust others to show us grace." That's what a church of broken people looks like. The second symptom we see of the humility of this tax collector is that he doesn't compare himself with others. If you happen for some reason this evening to be using a New American Standard Bible, then you may have noticed a difference in the translation of the tax collector's words in verse 13 compared with other versions. Because what the New American Standard Bible brings out, which the other versions fail to, is that there's a definite article in this, I think that's the right grammatical term, a definite article in this sentence relating to the word sinner. In other words, what the tax collector is actually saying at the end of verse 13 is not, "Have mercy on me, a sinner," but "Have mercy on me, the sinner." It's a strange way of phrasing it. So what does it tell us? Well, I think what it tells us is that the tax collector's view of himself here is not based on his view of other people. He doesn't class himself as a sinner, one of many sinners. In fact, he's not remotely concerned with categorizing other people or measuring them in comparison with himself. The impression you get from this is that this man could have been the only sinner in the world, and it wouldn't have affected his words here. It wouldn't have affected his judgment of himself. Or he could have been the most moral person in the world compared to others, and it still wouldn't have affected his judgment of himself. He would still be the sinner. Comparison with others simply doesn't come into it here with the tax collector. It doesn't enter his head as a relevant measuring device for his own condition. Regardless of what anyone else does, how anyone else compares, he is the sinner, and that's what matters. It's the only thing that matters. The final symptom that we see in the tax collector is that there's no inconsistency. We don't need to dwell on this too long, because it follows from the first two symptoms that there's evidently no inconsistency here between this man's private thoughts and words and his public life. This man was a tax collector. In the eyes of the people, he was a collaborator with the Roman Empire. And let's not underestimate the degree of suspicion and condemnation that this would have aroused against him. It wouldn't be exaggerating to compare it with how people viewed the treachery of Nazi collaborators during World War II. Where the Pharisee was generous, this man would have been full of greed. That's the only reason you'd take a job which incurred so much ridicule, surely. But the Pharisee wasn't a robber or a cheat. This man was both a robber and a cheat. Where the Pharisee was faithful to his wife, this man had openly betrayed his people, his friends, and his family for the sake of some extra cash. But do you see that in his humility here, the tax collector is completely consistent with that in what he says? There's no mismatch here between his public life and his private words. He seems to have a freedom here to be honest, not just before men, but before God. There's no pretense, no cover-up, no sham in what he says to God here. No shades of grey in his words, no twisting of the truth. He's completely free to be honest with God about his brokenness and his sinfulness. So there we have the three symptoms of humility that we see in this tax collector. But we need to conclude by looking at where these symptoms come from. What's the heart of true humility that lies behind these symptoms that we've seen? How is this tax collector able to behave so differently from the Pharisee? How is he able to drop the pretense or to resist the temptation to constantly compare himself with others, to be honest with God in private about his life in public? How can he do that? And it's really important that we understand this, because there is a danger here, a very subtle danger that we need to avoid. Because the truth is that it's possible to display these symptoms of humility without actually having a humble heart. In fact, it's possible to display these symptoms of humility in such a way that, far from flowing from a humble heart, it actually only serves to fuel our proud hearts all the more. In his book, The Screwtape Letters, C.S. Lewis makes this point in a really helpful and clear way. For those of you who haven't come across them, the Screwtape Letters are a series of fictional correspondence between a senior devil called Screwtape and his minion, who's called Wormwood. And in the letters, Screwtape is advising Wormwood on how to work to bring about the downfall of his latest patient, who's a man who's recently become a Christian. And they try all sorts of scheming. Screwtape's got lots of tricks up his sleeve. But in one of the letters, he focuses particularly on the man's humility. And this is his advice to Wormwood on that subject. He says, "I see only one thing to do at the moment. Your patient has become humble. Have you drawn his attention to the fact? All virtues are less formidable to us once the man is aware that he has them. But this is especially true of humility. Catch him at the moment when he is really poor in spirit and smuggle into his mind the gratifying reflection, 'By Jove, I'm being humble.'" This was written in the 1960s, I think, so bear with the language. "And almost immediately, pride at his own humility will appear. If he awakes to the danger and tries to smother this new form of pride, make him proud of his attempts, and so on through as many stages as you please." Do you see the point that Lewis is making? He's saying that there's a huge danger with humility. And that danger is that humility can so easily be just another way of fueling a Pharisaical pride. It can just become another part of the sham, another scene in the external performance. It's possible for us to look just like this tax collector, for us to have the appearance of humble brokenness, to not be constantly comparing ourselves with others, to be honest before God in prayer even, and yet at the very moment we're displaying these symptoms, we can be at our most proud. The truth is that we can so easily use our humility as just another way of fueling our desperate desire for the approval of men. Just another way of bolstering our righteous reputation in order to get that exaltation that we crave. I'm sure we've all experienced this, and my guess is that we can all appreciate from our experience what Lewis is describing there. This vicious cycle of humility and pride. Humility and then pride at our own humility, and then pride at our attempts to overcome our pride at our humility, and so on. It's a vicious cycle, and I'm sure we know it only too well. So how do we overcome this? How do we get past this? How do we avoid this seemingly unavoidable trap? Is it really possible to be truly, genuinely humble without it fueling our pride? Well, there is a way, and we see it in this passage. It's the way that the tax collector is humbled. So let's conclude this evening by seeing that the only way we can ever be truly humbled is through the radical grace of our humble King. And we see this in two words that appear, which we'll look at. One of them is in verse 13 and one in verse 14. So firstly, verse 13 tells us that if we want to be truly humble, we need to be humbled by the atoning mercy of God. We need to be humbled by the atoning mercy of God. The word that's translated as mercy in verse 13 is an unusual word. It's not the normal word that's translated as mercy in the New Testament. The usual word for mercy carries the meaning of compassion or undeserved kindness. But the word that's used here carries a deeper meaning than that, and it's significant. The mercy that the tax collector pleads for is an atoning mercy. The word used here has the same root as the word that's used in those great atoning sacrifice or propitiation verses in the New Testament. Verses like 1 John 4 verse 10, "This is love, not that we love God, but that he loved us and sent his son as an atoning sacrifice." That's the same root word there, atoning sacrifice for our sins. Hebrews 2 verse 17, "For this reason he had to be made like his brothers in every way, in order that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God, and that he might make atonement for the sins of the people." And Romans 3 verse 25, "God presented him as a sacrifice of atonement through faith in his blood." The mercy, that the specific brand of mercy that brings this tax collector to his knees, is the mercy of the cross of Jesus Christ. And it's only there that we see mercy which is powerful enough to humble us to the dust. Because at the cross of Jesus Christ, there's no room for even the smallest ounce of pride. So at the cross of Jesus Christ that we see the radical grace of our humble King. It's there that we see the only one who could truly thank God that he's not like other men. The one who could make every boast that the Pharisee makes and more besides without a hint of arrogance or pride. The one, the only one who is righteous through and through, not just on the outside, but on the inside. Righteous to the core. So at the cross of Jesus that we see the exalted one humbled. The King of Kings and the Lord of Lords becomes the sinner. And he becomes the sinner for us. And that's the only thing that can crush our pride and truly humble us. Martin Lloyd-Jones, he put it like this. He said, "There is only one thing I know of that crushes me to the ground and humiliates me to the dust. And that is to look at the Son of God, and especially contemplate the cross. Nothing else can do it. When I see that I am a sinner, that nothing but the Son of God on the cross can save me, I'm humbled to the dust. Nothing but the cross can give us this spirit of humility." And John Stott as well, he echoes those words. He says, "The cross tells some very unpalatable truths about ourselves, namely that we are sinners under the righteous curse of God's law, and we cannot save ourselves. If we could have been forgiven by our good works, we may be quite sure that there would have been no cross. Every time we look at the cross, Christ seems to be saying to us, 'I am here because of you. It is your sin I am bearing, your curse I am suffering, your death I am dying.' Nothing in history or in the universe cuts us down to size like the cross. All of us have inflated views of ourselves, especially in self-righteousness, until we have visited a place called Calvary. It is there, at the foot of the cross, that we shrink to our true size." We need to be humbled by the atoning mercy of God. Only the cross of Jesus can melt our proud hearts and make us humble from the inside out. And do you see how the cross of Jesus demolishes those symptoms of pride that we saw in the Pharisee and that we see in ourselves? The cross shows us the futility of outward performance. If it took the King of Kings from heaven to the humiliation of death on a cross to deal with our sin, then it reminds us again, it makes it abundantly clear that hollow outward performance will get us nowhere. It won't help us. The cross shows us that again and again. It shows us that without a shadow of a doubt, we are completely dependent on the radical grace of our humble King. And the cross shows us the futility of comparing ourselves with others. The cross is the great leveller, isn't it? Foot of the cross, everyone is brought low. No one is superior. No one has performed better. Everyone needs grace. Everyone needs the atoning mercy of God. If we want to be truly humble, we need to be humbled by the atoning mercy of God. But secondly, we see that in verse 14, that if we want to be truly humble, then we need to be humbled by the exalting approval of God. Do you remember what we concluded was at the heart of the Pharisees' pride? Having looked at the symptoms and pieced together the pieces of this picture of his proud heart, it became apparent that this man was a man who was desperate for the approval of other people. He was desperate to be exalted and praised and approved by those around him. And that's what drove him to this proud performance, to this constant comparison with others, and to this inner self-congratulation that belied his outward performance. But in verse 14, we see the contrast with the tax collector. The astonishing truth that we read in verse 14 is that the tax collector received the very approval that the Pharisee was craving. He received that exaltation, but he didn't receive it from men. He didn't receive it from those around him who were impressed with his tears of repentance and the depth of his contrition. The astounding declaration Jesus makes in verse 14 is that this tax collector, this greedy, treacherous, thieving cheat, this enemy collaborator, the sinner, this man goes home with the approval of God. He goes home declared righteous. He goes home spotlessly perfect in the sight of the radiant holy gods. And here we have the second weapon that kills our pride. The second gospel truth that can make us truly humble. Because while the atoning mercy of God shows us that we don't deserve the approval and exaltation of other people, the exalting approval of God, this justification that we receive freely from God through Jesus Christ, shows us that we don't need the approval and exaltation of other people. If you're a Christian here this evening, then you have the approval. You've been lifted up, you've been exalted by the only one whose approval really matters. You've been declared righteous by the gods of the universe. And so you've been set free. Set free from the constant need for the approval of others. Set free from having to keep up appearances and maintain reputation. Set free to drop that pretense, to live honestly and consistently without any shades of grey. No sham, no cover-up. Set free to be broken, humble people who are being healed and restored by the grace of the humble King. There's a recent Christian song that has these lyrics which summarise this thought. They say, so you thought you had to keep this up, all the work that you do, so we think that you're good. And you can't believe it's not enough. All the walls you build up are just glass on the outside. So let them fall down. There's freedom waiting in the sound when you let your walls fall to the ground. Will you let your walls fall to the ground? Will you let that pretense drop? Will you come back and remember again this astonishing grace of God, which declares us righteous, sets us free from the enslaving pursuit of the approval of other people? If we want to be truly humble, we need to be humbled by the exalting approval of God. There's no doubt that the battle with pride for all of us will be a lifelong one. And many of you have been fighting with it harder and longer than me, and it's still there. And so often it feels like the moment we gain ground in a battle, then we immediately slip further back than we were when battle commenced. But this passage gives us hope. It gives us hope that in the astonishing gospel of grace, there is power to make us humble. Power to transform us from the inside, to change our ugly, proud hearts into something beautiful. But that power only lies in the gospel of grace. If you don't know that gospel, if you haven't experienced the life-changing grace of Jesus Christ, then that's where you need to start. Without it, you'll only get prouder and prouder and harder until ultimately God hands you over to an eternity of living in your own pride, looking for approval in the wrong places and never being satisfied. Come to Christ and be humbled by the radical grace of the humble King and receive this approval of God's grace. And if you know this gospel, if you know it already, the next time you feel that pride and the intensity of the battle rises, don't try and make yourself humble. Don't fight your pride with your own weak efforts. At best, it will fail, and at worst, it will make your pride even stronger. When pride comes, then go to the gospel. Go to the cross of Jesus and discover again transforming power. If we stray far from the cross, then pride waits in the shadows, ready to attack us, ready to pick us off. But if we stay near the cross, if we make our stand in the battle on the hill of Calvary, then there is hope that the God who transforms ugly things into beautiful things will transform our ugly pride into beautiful, attractive humility. And God is a God who loves humility.